Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The Cuban Missile Crisis might be briefly touched upon in your average U.S. history class these days, but for those who lived through it, it was terrifying as Americans seriously contemplated dying in a nuclear war. The crisis emerged in the fall of 1962 when U.S. spy planes photographed Soviet nuclear missiles being assembled in nearby Cuba. Here's President Kennedy speaking to the nation on October 22, 1962.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
Now, a new book by two New England authors describes just how close we came to nuclear Armageddon and the men who prevented that outcome. It's called Above and Beyond: John F. Kennedy and America's Most Dangerous Cold War Spy Mission. Author Michael Tagayas is here. His co-author is Casey Sherman. And Michael, welcome. It's really nice to meet you. Thanks for making time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into all the different characters, you know, JFK, the pilots, all the others who were involved, including on the Russian side, which is really interesting, just remind us, please, Michael, how terrifying this was once the president went on TV and revealed that information.
Some people actually went out to their backyards and started digging bomb shelters. It was that scary. And even though Kennedy delivered that message with a calm but firm tone, people knew what he was talking about in terms of how close we were. So even in the book, one of the U-2 spy plane pilots, who's an Air Force veteran, been in combat, he said, "I got down on my knees after listening to Kennedy and started praying." Because he didn't know just how close it was.
Well, there are a bunch of stories in the book about how the country's leaders responded, the plans they were making.
Yes.
Just give us a couple of those, Michael. Like, you know, take the kids and drive to Missouri, I think was the instructions for one person.
That was one. And then Jackie Kennedy was told, "We're going to take you to Mount Weather, where there's this underground cave just outside of D.C., And she refused. She said, "We're going to stay right here. If we all go, we're going to go as a family."
Wow.
But they were, starting to evacuate some people.
Robert Kennedy Jr. told you a story about how at his school, kids were told, like little kids, I don't know, 10-year-olds or something, were told to consider the ethics of who gets into the bomb shelter and who doesn't.
I can't imagine that coming, you know, so close to what's happening. But that, you know, people, and we all knew there weren't enough bomb shelters for everybody anyway. So people were glued to their TV sets and their radios going, "What next?"
Well, and you were born in 1955. I looked
yes.
this up. So you're 7 when this is happening. Michael, what memories do you have of this time?
Just very vague. The assassination of JFK was a much stronger memory for me, maybe because I was a year older. So mine are vague, but I remember talking to my parents later and saying, "Yeah, we had that TV set going nonstop."
Well, I want to remind our listeners that we'd love to hear from you, especially if you do have memories of this time. We'd love to share to hear you share them with us. And if you don't have personal recollections about this, what questions do you have about the Cuban Missile Crisis? What gaps in your understanding do you have about this time? Again, you can join us. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. You can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We're looking at a new book called Above and Beyond: The co-author Michael Tugayas is with us. It's about the Cuban Missile Crisis and the men involved in helping prevent nuclear Armageddon. Again, you can join us with your memories, thoughts, questions, 1-800-892-6477. So as you were saying, Michael, you know, this was real for people. They really, some of them were just going and building bomb shelters, going out and praying that the worst would not happen. I want to play a little bit more of that speech from JFK. Again, October 22nd, 1962. This is considered one of the most alarming speeches from the Cold War, really just raising the possibility of the world's two superpowers lobbing nuclear missiles at each other. Let's hear a little bit more.
Shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union. I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and to stable relations between our two nations. I call upon him further to abandon this course of world domination and to join in an historic effort to end the perilous arms race and to transform the history of man.
Okay, so there you have it, Michael, requiring a full retaliatory response. He's not, you know, messing around.
Wow. It gives me goosebumps, even though I've heard this before. It just still gives me goosebumps. Yeah, he laid everything out on the table and actually phrased it in such a way that almost pitted the whole Western Hemisphere, because he said, you know, any missile coming from Cuba against any country here, well, they were only going to shoot at us. There were no other countries they were aiming at. But he phrased it in such a way, it'll call for the full retaliatory strike back against the Soviets.
And it seems amazing to hear him even present that possibility.
That's for sure. And then on the other hand, he also presents the possibility that discussions can lead to something much bigger and better between the two countries. So, you know, in that one little clip we heard, there's a lot there going on.
Well, how would you describe these times, Michael, to someone who wasn't familiar with it, maybe somebody born, you know, in the mid-1990s, the Cold War that provides the context for this story of the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, most people are familiar with the shoot down of Gary Powers in a U-2 spy plane over Russia and all that followed, because the Soviets were able to capture him and the plane and put Eisenhower on the defensive. But it shows just how tense it was between, you know, these two different worlds, if you will. Then Kennedy comes into office and there's already a plan to invade Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. And Kennedy makes the mistake of not asking enough questions, not getting enough advisors, and kind of goes along with this preconceived plan under the Eisenhower administration. Kennedy's starting to get cold feet as it's nearing, and he pulls back some air support. And needless to say, the whole invasion is a disaster. It's over before it barely began. And in a way, I think that was a good thing, because it forced Kennedy to handle the Cuban Missile Crisis very differently than he did the Bay of Pigs.
Well, and most people listening would think, oh, Bay of Pigs, right, JFK, kind of a disaster. But that plan started with the Eisenhower administration to topple Castro?
Yes, and we'd been trying to topple Castro since almost day one that he came into power. Even the Kennedy administration had plans to assassinate him. And, you know, but the Bay of Pigs showed how inexperienced Kennedy was, but he learned from it, and thank God he did.
Do you think that it's partly that Bay of Pigs fiasco, a word often associated with it, was part of the reason why the Soviet Union put these offensive missiles right on our back doorstep? They thought, well, this guy Kennedy, you know, he's not very impressive.
Yeah, I do. I think
it emboldened them.
I think they thought Kennedy might be a pushover. Part of that comes from a summit meeting that the two leaders had in Vienna. I think that they thought, once we get these missiles in Cuba, there's no way the U.S. is going to invade the island, and it'll level the playing field. The U.S. has missiles very close to our border, us being the Soviets. And Khrushchev said, let's see how they feel now with missiles on their doorstep.
So these are the missiles that the U.S. had in Turkey, the
Turkey,
USSR.
And Italy, yeah. Yes, and the U.K.
So they just thought, you've got missiles pointing at us, we'll have missiles pointing at you.
Exactly, and closer so they could reach Washington, D.C. in something like 12 minutes.
So why was that seen by American leaders as different? Did anybody in this country say, yeah, they kind of have a point there?
Adlai Stevenson did. He was the first. And
he was the U.N. ambassador.
The U.N. ambassador at the time.
And a twice-failed Democratic presidential
candidate. Yeah, actually ran against Kennedy. But I think Kennedy viewed it not just from a military standpoint. Yes, this puts them right on our shores, and they can hit us, you know, without warning and very little time to respond. But on the other hand, you've got these missiles there, and you've got Castro as a kind of a loose cannon as well. And that plays a role in where it's all going to go as well. Luckily, Khrushchev did not give Castro control over the surface-to-air missiles protecting the island. A lot of people think, you know, the Cubans had control of them, but the Russians were like, no way.
So the Russians were really calling the shots in Cuba.
Yes.
Much to Castro's frustration, as we'll hear about later in this
yes.
show, as things get hotter and hotter, Castro says, come on, let's go, let's do this. And Khrushchev says, no, not now, not yet, maybe never.
Right.
Let's go to our listeners. Lots of people sharing their memories, thoughts, recollections, and maybe some questions about this intense, terrifying time in U.S. history. The Cuban Missile Crisis, 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Michael, let's go first to Goffstown, where Eveline is on the line. Hi, Eveline. Go ahead. You're in the air.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was about 9 years old when all of this was going on, and my father had us do air raid drills down to the basement from the top, a bedroom on the third floor, and he would time us to make sure that we could get down there within about 2 minutes. And he had bottled water, he had canned goods, he had, you know, change of clothing.
Wow.
And we had no idea why we were doing all this, but I was the next to the oldest of five, and we were just, Dad would say, run, we'd run.
Well,
and it was kind of scary.
Of course.
We doing it.
So he didn't explain to you that, you know, we might get into a nuclear war with the USSR.
No, I don't think we would have really understood that. He just said, Daddy wants to keep you safe.
Wow. And how long did this go on?
We did it for a couple of months, just, yep. You know, maybe once a week. And, you know, he had everything down there that we would need, but who knows what would have happened if it really had happened. Ooh,
wow.
It's scary.
Eveline, it's great to hear from you, and I hope others call in and share their memories or ask questions about this. Thank you so much. You know, her call makes me think, Michael, about the public. You know, Kennedy goes on
right.
TV. He says this is a possibility. Was there any skepticism among the public that, you know, oh, come on, this isn't really happening?
I never came across that. No,
really?
No, and it wasn't complete panic or anything like that. It was more like what this woman, a caller, just explained. And the way she phrased it really brought it home for me, that they timed them running to the basement. And then also that she said, I thought she'd say, oh, we did this for 13 days because that's how long the crisis lasted. But she said it went on for 2 months, and I could understand that because it took some time to get those missiles out of there. And were they really going to do it, or was this deal going to fold?
Well, and the Kennedy administration based its policies on U-2 technology, these U-2
yes.
spy planes that are a big part of this book, and really gave the public and the administration clear photos of what was going on. Talk about how important those photos were. It's almost like the U-2 planes and pilots are a major character in this story.
They really are. And that, you know, really the premise of the book is that one of those U-2 pilots was shot down and killed. And we'll talk about that later. It's something I didn't even know. And I'm a big history buff.
Yeah.
But the U-2 spy planes could do something no other plane could do, fly at 13 miles high and yet get these clear photographs. So if we did not launch on October 14th, that's when we got the first photos of the missiles, the missiles would have been operational within 2 weeks, and Khrushchev would have achieved his goal. Because once they were operational, then what could we do? You can't take them out because they'll fire them. So we had this little window of time, and that's why it's called the 13 days. But without the U-2 spy planes discovering them, we were falling into the Soviet trap of telling us, yes, we're doing a military buildup on the island, but that's because you invaded it, so we're putting in defensive weapons. There's nothing offensive there. There's certainly no nuclear missiles. And most people believe that, and our intelligence supported that until, you know, we started to get some signals that, hey, something bigger is going on. We got to launch the U-2s.
So they were lying. They said basically this is defensive because you guys invaded Bay of Pigs, so we're just going to defend our friend here.
Exactly.
I want to play a little clip, Michael, of Dino Brogioni. He analyzed the photos. It's amazing to hear from him. He analyzed the photos and briefed the president and the U.N. Security Council about what the photos showed. Detailed evidence, as you said, that these Russian missile sites were not just defensive in nature. Now, this is from a Smithsonian documentary, and in it, he just talks about how vital this photographic evidence really was.
Now, this created quite a stir among the military because it meant that the second site, an intermediate-range ballistic missile site, could hit every major target in the United States except the extreme northwest. This was the first time that aerial photography was displayed at the United Nations Security Council. And it had an enormous impact, not only on the United States, but on the world, that the Russians had been lying all the time.
Again, that's Dino Brogioni. He analyzed the photos during the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's him speaking with the Smithsonian. Boy, what do you think about hearing from him, Michael? What comes up for you?
Wow. You know, when he said they could strike anywhere in the U.S. except the extreme northwest, and again, they could do so quickly because they're so close to our borders. And, you know, a point I was going to make earlier and I forgot was that Kennedy didn't view this as just a military threat, but also a political one. He said, if I don't get these missiles out of there, I'm going to be impeached. No one is going to stand for this. So right off the bat, he's made a decision. The missiles have to go. What he hasn't made is the plan to remove them. He's very flexible on what options he's going to consider. But that goal, the missiles have to go, was never in question from day one from Kennedy.
Well, and it's striking to me that that you can't, or maybe at the time, you couldn't ship these things over, you know, ready to go, so to speak. You had to have the time to assemble them.
Yes.
So they become offensive in nature. I was kind of struck by that as
well. Right, the launch pads, the erectors, the nuclear warheads. We weren't even sure if they had the nuclear warheads in Cuba, and turned out they did. And, you know, it's very interesting. When Kennedy was informed, it was he had just woken up. He was still in his pajamas. And it was told there's nuclear weapons in Cuba, Mr. President, and missiles that can reach Washington. His first question, mine might have been, how many, where, this, that. His first question was, when will they be operational?
How much time do I have?
Because, right, he wants to establish how much time does he have to try different tactics to get them out before it's the final tactic, which is World War III.
Well, and thank goodness for the U-2 pilots and the pictures that they took, because they allowed JFK and his advisors to see for real what was going on instead of just accepting the untruths, lies from the Soviet diplomats that they had heard. So after a break, Michael, we should dig into this U-2 program, these pilots, what they did, how they felt about it. And we'll take a lot more of your calls as well. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Emails are welcome, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, and we'll be right back.
What car would you buy with $25,000? If you're the grand prize winner of NHPR Summer Car Raffle, the choice is up to you. You could go with something practical, fuel efficient, or get something with a little muscle.
Guess you better slow your Mustang down.
But don't wait, we're picking the lucky winner this Saturday at 2 p.m. Get in on the fun for as little as $50 or get 6 tickets for $150. The more you buy, the better the deal at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Above and Beyond. It's a new book about the Cuban Missile Crisis and the U-2 spy missions that provided the photographic evidence at the heart of this story. We're talking with one of the book's co-authors, Michael Tagayas. If you have memories of that time, we'd love for you to share them with us. And if you don't have personal recollections about this, what questions do you have? What gaps in your understanding about this time period have you always sort of had? Again, you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Michael, let's go back to our listeners. Bill is calling from Franklin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, I just wanted to share a story. I'm an older man, and I can remember way back when I was a boy. And during the Cuban Missile Crisis, my parents sent me down to our local supermarket. Now it's a Johnny's Food Mass. It was called Elm Farm back then. Over there in Edgeworth, Mass., which is between Medford and Malden. And in the parking lot, believe it or not, they actually had a model of an actual fallout shelter, and you could go in there and you could see how you get in, and you could see this tube on top so that, and it showed it had a filter to draw in clean air that would filter out radioactive fallout, and you had all this room for bunks for your family and places to store water, and you could purchase this thing, bury it in your backyard. And in an atomic disaster, you could run out in the backyard with the family, climb down into it, and survive that way.
Wow. So
yeah, they actually had that. Yeah, I remember it, and I don't think anyone ever bought one, but they had it.
Well, so go to the store, Bill, and pick up milk, bread, eggs, and a fallout shelter. Thank you so much for calling. This is amazing, Michael.
Wow,
what do you think?
I never knew about that. That's incredible.
Did you have a fallout shelter?
No.
You were told to go down in the basement?
No, I don't remember that. And, 99.9% of people did not have the necessary fallout shelter or equipment or anything else. So, we were exposed.
Well, here's an email from Doug in Mason. He says, that was during my first year of college. Each floor of the dorm had a central room with a television. Everyone gathered around for President Kennedy's address. Doug says he went through with his explanation. Then came the line, I hereby declare a state of, and there was a collective gasp. Mm. We expected him to say war, and then he said embargo on Cuba. And I mean, wow. Phew, yeah, everyone. So this gets us to, I mean, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but in the end, Kennedy decided not to go straight to war. Thank goodness. He decided to do this embargo on Cuba. What was that? What was the goal there? What was that about?
Well, he had assembled his closest team of advisors called the EXCOM, the Executive Committee, and most advisors and Kennedy himself on the first day of deliberations were for us going in with a massive airstrike, taking out the missiles, taking out the surface-to-air missiles that protected the nuclear missiles. But he didn't give the okay because he knew he had a little more time. And then over the next two sessions, he's starting to think, my God, this millions of people could die if we do this. They're going to respond. And Curtis LeMay, the Air Force general, is at one of the meetings. And Kennedy goes, so if we do this, what do you think the Russians will do? And LeMay goes, absolutely nothing. We're stronger. And Kennedy goes, you don't think they'll go and take West Berlin immediately and respond? And LeMay goes, no, we've got to go in now while we have the element of surprise. And thank God Kennedy let him speak, didn't dismiss LeMay, but didn't succumb to the pressure from LeMay and all the Joint Chiefs and all the heads of the different military branches. They were all for, hey, we've got to move in fast to get them by surprise. Every day we wait, they're in a more defensive position to protect these missiles.
So day by day, the pressure increases because day by day, these missiles are becoming more operational as offensive missiles.
Exactly.
So one of the early ideas then was to go in and take these things out before they became offensive, Michael?
Take them out and then launch a full-scale invasion on the scale of D-Day to take over the island. We had wanted to take over the island for a long time, and here was our chance. But Kennedy's, you know, having been in war himself, seen blood and had two of his people die during the PT-109 that we write about in Above and Beyond, because we want to show the reader this guy, Kennedy, had been there in war. He's pausing, and he's thinking, if I go to that step, that's it. That there are no steps after that. That's war. Why don't I try something where I have some options still in front of me if it doesn't work? So he calls for this quarantine. He didn't want to use the word blockade because it's illegal to do a blockade on the high seas. So he calls it a quarantine. And many of his advisors go, that'll never work. And Kennedy, I'm paraphrasing, says something to the effect, that may be, but that's just our first step. We've got more we can do, obviously, after that. And this will give the Russians time to think as well. At first, they were going to have that quarantine line at 800 miles out. Then he moved it to 500, saying, let's give him a little more time to approach, to think about it.
He's under a lot of pressure, though, from this XCOM, some members of the XCOM.
I would have cracked. It's unbelievable.
To just go for it.
Yeah, in night and day meetings on this, and he's so young, 43 years old, but handles it so smoothly. He secretly tape recorded every meeting of this group. They didn't even know they were being taped, but he had a little switch under the cabinet room desk, and he caught it all on tape. So you can listen. You can hear some of it online. We took the more interesting parts and put it in Above and Beyond, so you see that pushback that he's getting from the military advisors and from the Secretary of Defense.
Well, and the impression that you get of Kennedy from this book is, as you said, just the calmness, the steadiness, despite all the challenges. You say in the book, a lesser person surely would have cracked under the strain. Nuclear war might have followed. You hinted at this, but I'd like to ask you, Michael, where did that mental discipline, that calm under pressure, that ability not to freak out, where did that come from?
I think part of it came from the lesson of the Bay of Pigs, that I am not going to be rushed into anything, because he kept asking, are they operational yet? And the U-2s were still flying, sitting ducks with no weapons on board, just their cameras. And he knew that the warheads were not on the missiles, and some of them were not on the launch pad. So he knew he had a little time to play with, and he was communicating with Khrushchev daily through cables back and forth. And the tone was interesting. They were always respectful, firm but respectful, both sides giving their point of view, and at least they had this dialogue going.
There's a whole chapter in the book about that PT boat experience in World War II that JFK had. I'd never read a detailed account of it. I knew he was sort of a World War II hero, but I wasn't really sure why. Hit by the Japanese somewhere in the South Pacific. I lost count, Michael, of how many miles JFK had to swim from island to island.
Wasn't it?
Unbelievable. It's unbelievable. You say he put his body and mind through an ordeal that would have broken most men.
It was amazing. You know, those men survived largely because of Kennedy himself, both physically and mentally, getting him through that ordeal.
Having that experience in war.
Yes.
Made him more cautious than perhaps someone who had not been to war and seen, you know, people die.
Right, seeing friends, men that worked under him die. You know, two of those PT-109 crew members died. So he'd seen war up close, and it's not some faraway, distant thing. And he says in one of the meetings, it's very interesting, we're all talking about this, you know, harsh reaction and immediate strike. But he said, as soon as the blood starts flowing, people are going to start to think differently.
Another aspect of Kennedy's calmness, it's even more noteworthy, Michael, because you tell us that he was in constant back pain. And again, before I read this book, I sort of knew he had back problems and he had a lot of illnesses, but this pain was excruciating at times. How did he manage it?
A fair amount of drugs, number one. He would swim in the pool daily. That was his form of release and exercise.
And stretching out his back.
Stretching, yeah. Even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he would find at least 10 minutes to get in that pool. The buoyancy, I guess, you know, relieved the strain. When he was in the Oval Office, he often sat in a rocking chair. He found that the most comfortable position.
He wore a corset sometimes to get him to sit up straight and kind of stretch the back out. He took all sorts of drugs. At one point, one of his advisors, maybe it's even his brother, says, "What's in all those drugs? You might want to think about that." And he says, "Nope, as long as it makes me feel better, I'm taking it."
And you know what? It did not affect his personality during the Cuban Missile Crisis because he's sharp as a tack. His questioning is spot on. And so whatever he was taking worked for the pain but did not cloud his mind, that's for sure.
Lots more reflections from our listeners. Michael, Gloria sent us an email to say, "I was in high school during the missile crisis. One of the things that contributed to our fear that a nuclear war was a very real possibility was the memory of Nikita Khrushchev, then head of the Soviet Union, banging his shoe on the table at the UN and declaring, 'We will bury you.'" So she makes a good point. They were seeming kind of threatening back then.
That's for sure. Yet, when I dug into Khrushchev more, I found him to be a very shrewd man, not this mercurial person that goes off the rails.
That's the image that you often see.
And I talked to his son, Sergei, and I had a great conversation with him. And I'll never forget, he said something that really resonated. He said, "My father, his one fear through this was that things were going to spin out of control, that somebody without his authorization would do something that would lead us down the path to nuclear war." And I remember responding, "Wow, that was Kennedy's number one fear that he said to Bobby, that I'm just afraid it's going to get out of hand and then I can't stop it."
Right. Then if it gets too big, and they both really fear this, you know, some pilot or some submarine captain or somebody somewhere will make a miscalculation, or somebody on the Cuban side, which, as we said earlier, Castro was kind of chomping at the bit. Somebody's going to make a miscalculation. There'll be a misunderstanding. And
those fears
boom.
Are well-founded, because that's exactly what happens in three or four different cases.
Because Rudy Anderson, one of the U-2 pilots, for example, is shot down, not on the orders of Khrushchev. Who shot him down?
The two generals on the ground in Cuba did not have authorization to shoot down the U-2s because Khrushchev was afraid that would start the war.
He was very measured, by the way.
Yes.
He knew that these U-2s were spying on his
activities. Oh, they knew, yeah.
And he did not shoot them down.
On radar. But these two generals thought there was some wiggle room in their instructions that said only in the case of if war breaks out. Well, they think war is imminent in terms of the next 12 hours. And we were ramping up for this full-scale invasion. Florida was just loaded with every piece of military equipment for the invasion and the airstrikes. So they decide, and this is their words, they go, "Target number 33, which is Rudy Anderson taking the pictures over Cuba in his spy plane, our guest has been here quite a while." And then they go, "We've decided to remove target number 33. And so they radio the surface-to-air missile site in Banyes, Cuba, and they say, "Destroy target number 33.
And that's Rudy Anderson.
And that's Rudy Anderson.
Who, by the way, is a pacifist. That's why he decided to fly reconnaissance missions, because he didn't want to shoot anybody down.
Isn't that something?
Let's take another call. And again, the number for you to join us with your questions, recollections, 1-800-892-6477. Email is great, exchange@nhpr.org. And Bill's calling from Rye. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to add another kind of layer onto this whole thing. It was with the strategic initiative that went on during the Cuban Missile Crisis. My father was in the 509 bomb wing stationed at Pease Air Force Base, along with the 100th bomb wing. Both of these are nuclear-capable bomb wings. And during that particular period of time, my father was a radar operator navigator on a B-47. And early in that morning, he showed up at the house and collected a few of his belongings and told my mother and me that he would be gone for a few days, but don't worry, he'd be back. So that was the alarm went off. The alert was launched. The B-47s were on the ramp. They loaded their nuclear weapons, and they were all gone. And they were all gone because they were afraid that there would be sea-launched cruise missiles from Soviet submarines that would attack Pease because we're right on the coast.
Right.
So they left. We lived through the entire crisis, and my dad showed up about a week later with his dirty underwear and all the paraphernalia that he had. I said, "Well, Dad, where have you been this entire week?" He said, "Well, we were away." And so when he was unpacking
away.
His stuff,
yeah,
we were away. When he was unpacking his stuff, a matchbook fell out of his belongings, and it was from Thule Air Force Base in Greenland. And so what had happened was they flew up there with their nuclear weapons and sat on the tarmac there for the entire time with engines running, waiting for the command to take off to nuke the Soviet Union.
Oh, my goodness, Bill. What a story.
So And so this was really a very interesting time for all of us. But, you know, through this whole time, I mean, the civilians were all a twiddle about nuclear war and that kind of stuff. But, you know, being an Air Force brat, living on an Air Force base my entire time, my entire life practically, there was never any panic. There was never any run under your bed or anything like that. It said, we are just here and just wait it out.
So if the worst had happened, your dad would have been on one of those planes, Bill, you know, that would have gone over to Russia and dropped bombs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the 100th Bomb Wing, the 509th Bomb Wing, all nuclear capable, all loaded with nuclear weapons, and they were dispersed all over the world. In fact, there were some at Logan Airport sitting on the tarmac there as well.
Yeah, Bill, we had, and you know this, we had planes in the sky at all times with nuclear weapons all over the world, all over the Mediterranean. And that's why folks like your dad were gone, because they were going nonstop, either, like you said, on the runway with the engines warmed or in the skies.
Well,
right, exactly.
Bill, my jaw is dropped. Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
Well, and they just, you know, they sat on the runway in the airplane for the entire week. They,
wow.
They'd bring meals out to them. They would urinate on the tarmac, but they didn't leave the airplane.
Bill, thank you so much for calling. Amazing story. And it just shows you, Michael, as you said earlier, you know, the nation was bristling. I mean, we were ready to go.
Right. That was a great call, because he brings it to life that these guys couldn't even leave the plane. For a week straight, he's living on the plane that's loaded with nuclear weapons. And, you know, just one false move by one commander, one loose cannon, one, like we had mentioned on the Russian side, they shoot down one of our planes with no authorization from their leadership. They figured that that was the smart thing to do, and they were wrong.
After a short break, I don't want to have you start it now, but after a short break, there's a Russian who makes the opposite choice. He is encouraged to shoot. He's in a submarine. He decides not to. Mm. And somebody once said that that guy also helped prevent World War III. So we'll talk about him after a short break. Take a lot more of your calls, too. Wow, Bill, thank you so much for that one. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More on the Cuban Missile Crisis and a fresh look at it in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, we continue our special summer series, Going Local, exploring the regions of our state. This week, it's the White Mountains. Visit nhpr.org/exchange to submit your questions and comments about life in the White Mountains. Join us tomorrow morning live at 9. This hour, untold stories about the Cuban Missile Crisis with author Michael Tagayas and his new book, Above and Beyond, JF Kennedy, John F. Kennedy and America's Most Dangerous Cold War Spy Mission, co-authored with Casey Sherman. Let's hear from you. We've been getting some great stories, questions, comments, reflections of that time. Join us 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Michael, we talked earlier about how both Khrushchev and Kennedy worried that, you know, one little mistake from someone lower down on the food chain could really explode this into World War III. You talked about the generals on Cuba that shot down U-2 pilot Rudy Anderson. There's another guy, I love this story, Vasily Arkhipov, a Russian sub-commander who, as somebody in this book told you, helped save the world. Now, who was this guy?
He really did. There was a Russian sub B-59 that we were dropping practice depth charges that was supposed to be the signal, hey, we found your position, you have to come to the surface, you're near the quarantine line.
This is near the blockade of the island of Cuba, not just on ships, but subs. So this is how you tell a sub, come on up, we see you.
Right.
Okay.
So we dropped these, and now, did he know they were practice? We don't know. He might have thought they were real. We had told the Russians we dropped three or four. We dropped over 20 on this sub. So the commander of the sub thinks war has broken out. This is it. World War III is breaking out. They're trying to drop me to the bottom of the sea because he's being rattled, like in their words, in a barrel, they described it. So he says, ready the special torpedo. Each sub had one nuclear torpedo, and he has it loaded into launch tube number 3. And thank God this other commander is on board. He was the flotilla commander. He wasn't command of this particular sub, so he was of equal rank. And he says, my God, what are you doing? We don't know if war has broken out. We're down here just being rattled around. And they get in an argument, and thank God Vasily wins the argument and says, we should come up. We don't know. We don't have authorization to fire the missile.
Talk about calmness and presence of mind.
Yeah, so he, in many respects, he did save the world. If he wasn't there, this commander would have fired his nuclear torpedo, taken out the aircraft carrier, and all hell would have broke loose.
So who's going to play him in the movie? That's what I want to know. I mean, I'm just imagining that scene. Well, one more sort of hero of this story, and there are lots of them that we should talk about. Chuck Maltsby, am I pronouncing that right? Yeah.
Yes. Chuck was a U-2 pilot as well, actually was a fighter pilot before that, been captured by the Chinese, been a horrific POW experience, but gets back in the Air Force and joins the U-2 spy plane program. And he's up in Alaska, and he's supposed to do a mission over the North Pole just to collect radioactive samples to monitor what the Soviets are doing. So this is, it's not a routine mission, but this had been something ongoing. But his is going to be a long one, all the way to the North Pole. And when they leave land bases, believe it or not, they're flying by celestial navigation. So, because there are no radio beacons below, no land masses to look at. You're just over this ice shield. And what happens? The aurora borealis appears, the northern lights. So it temporarily blinds him from being able to see the stars to get his fixes. So on his way back, he gets lost. He's off course. He's supposed to come back the same way he went up to Eisen Air Force Base, and he strays over Russian airspace. The Russians see him coming on their radar, and they're like, what's this, the vanguard of a U.S. attack? So they send up MiGs to intercept whatever this aircraft is coming in. Maltsby, his first clue that he's lost in a serious way is Russian music coming over his radio.
Well, and they're a little sneaky, too. They sort of say, hey, identify yourself. And he's not sure if it's Americans trying to save him. And then he hears Russian music.
Yes, right. Someone had come on the radio and said, we'd
like
you.
Loud and clear, by the way.
Right. And with a, you know, no Russian accent, so it was a linguist. And he's not sure who this is. Is this friend or foe? So he gives the code word, waiting for the code word response, and it doesn't come, and he knows it's the Russians trying to coax him in further so they can shoot him down. Then he notices, oh, my God, I'm almost out of fuel. So he takes the high-risk maneuver of shutting down the aircraft to glide, which means you lose cabin pressure. You would normally you die if you were just up there in this plane, 13 miles up. You would die. Your blood would boil. But he's got the pressure suit on.
Yeah, they had special suits.
Special
these
suits,
pilots.
Fishbowl helmets, and he's trying to coast back towards Alaska. We know he's in trouble by now. We launch four fighter jets, and they have nuclear-tipped missiles on them, and they're all coming together to meet. You have him gliding out. You have the Russians coming up, and you have our four fighter jets coming. I don't want to give away the whole book, but it's just air-raising how close we came over the Bering Sea to nuclear war in another case, just like the sub.
Well, and when I was reading that chapter, and you're right, we don't want to give the whole thing away, although we all know that that nuclear war did not break out. But when I was starting to read that chapter, I thought, okay, this is interesting, but why do I care about this guy getting lost over Alaska? But it's because everything was so heightened, any misperception could have blown things up.
And that was on the very day, on the very hour that Major Rudy Anderson is being shot down over Cuba. So that day is forever known as Black Saturday because it's the darkest day in the history of the world. It appears that within the next 12 hours, there'll be Armageddon.
Let's take another call. This is Will in Auburn. Hi, Will. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. I can remember vividly October of 1962 because I was 19 and on board the USS Okinawa, which was a helicopter carrier. And we were on station as part of the, and I know it was mentioned, it wasn't called a blockade, it was a quarantine, but we knew it was a blockade. And when we were told that we were going to Mayport, Florida, after we had been part of the blockade for maybe about 7 days, we didn't know exactly what we were going to, and we found out very quickly. The crew unloaded or loaded ammunition and food and approximately 2,000 Marines. And at that point, you know, being 19, we thought, and many of us who were young, thought this is it. We're going to invade Cuba if we don't have this. And then later, of course, I found out about the incident with the Soviet sub and the man who saved the world, Vasily Arakov. And that made it wow. Because we were a large ship as well. I think it was the Randolph, was it not, that was targeted.
Yes.
Had the Arakov agreed to launch with the other two officers that 14, I think, kiloton torpedo missile.
Yes.
So, Will, you were really, you know, you had some serious work in front of you, so maybe you didn't have time to sort of think or feel, but do you remember anything about how you felt? I mean,
yeah, I felt many of us. I was 19. I didn't think I'd live to see my 20th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
That's how tense it was, and we knew how tense it was. And you know, we thank goodness for Kennedy and Khrushchev, and thank God for the man who saved the world. I think.
Yes.
A good friend of mine was going to name his firstborn Vasily.
During the Cold War, I don't know how that would have gone over, but I appreciate the sentiment. Will, it's fantastic to hear from you. Thank you so much for that call.
And
amazing.
Will's comment that he may not have seen his 20th birthday is correct, because had we done the invasion, and he just confirmed that he was loading his ship with Marines, they would have been met by tactical nuclear weapons on the ground in Cuba. We didn't know that the Soviets had also delivered battlefield nuclear weapons, but they had cruise missiles. They had all the battlefield nuclear weapons. So it would not have been this easy invasion at all. We would have lost a lot of men.
Lots more reflections from our listeners. Dennis in Concord emailed to say, I was an active duty Marine, 1958 to 62, served the last 2 years in Hawaii. Upon arrival to my parents' home in Brooklyn, I literally sat on my sea bag watching President Kennedy on TV. I thought for sure that I was going to be called back in. I started to receive postcards from all over the Caribbean from others I had just left behind in Hawaii. As it turns out, they had been put on ships and sent through the Panama Canal and spread out over various islands in case needed. Peace and Semper Fi, Dennis says. Dennis, thank you so much. Sue in Newmarket says, I heard a fascinating recorded conversation between Kennedy and Eisenhower. Kennedy was wise enough to call Ike for advice. Mm. The discussion was calm and deliberate. They talked about Khrushchev as if he were a neighbor. JFK asked Ike if he thought Khrushchev was bluffing, and Ike said, oh, I think he is.
Wow. And isn't that something that Kennedy, a Democrat, would call a Republican for advice, and they would brainstorm, and it's true. And that's just what he did. Even on his XCOM committee, he had people with dissenting viewpoints, but he wanted to hear it all.
Yeah, and they were both, Ike, obviously, and Kennedy, both veterans of World War II,
right.
So they had that combat appreciation for what this what this could mean. We should talk about the chapter, The Day of the Doves, and how this crisis was resolved, Michael. First off, who were the doves?
Basically, Bobby came around to Jack's point of view that we can't do this first,
gotta find another
first
way.
Step without any other options. So the blockade was working to a certain extent, but the clock's ticking because the missiles are going to be armed in a certain amount of time. So He, being President Kennedy, gave it one last shot, and that was, he tells Bobby, go to the Soviet foreign minister and deliver this message that if you remove your missiles from Cuba, we will promise, one, not to invade, and two, we will remove our missiles from Turkey at a later date, but that has to be kept secret between the two of us. And he, although he never calls it an ultimatum, he tells Bobby, let them know that really within 12 hours, we're going to have to take action. It's that close. And Sergei, the son of the premier, said, when my father got that information on the heels of Rudy Anderson being shot down without his authorization, with Chuck Maltsby's mistake of entering Russian airspace.
Which could have also blown things up, yeah.
Right. They don't even know about what happened on the sub. But he said, my father realized this is it. Things are spinning out of control. I got to take this deal. He didn't want nuclear war either. I mean, he wasn't a crazy man, Khrushchev. He didn't want it to happen. So he thought this was a fair exchange and agreed to it and didn't even want to wait a few hours and do it by cable. He just went on the radio. So, because we were monitoring Russian radio, and said, we've agreed to a deal with the U.S. about removing the missiles in exchange for the safety of Cuba.
By the way, I was also struck by the role that Bobby Kennedy played in this crisis. I mean, he was Attorney General, which isn't normally a role you would think. You'd think it'd be the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, but a trusted advisor, obviously, by his brother.
He
plays a huge role.
Definitely the right-hand man. He was the confidant. He was probably the only one at the XCOM meetings that knew he was being tape recorded. Mm-hmm. They were close, yeah.
So in the end, you must have learned so much from writing this book, Michael. And there's probably more in here that you couldn't even put in. What do you think is going to be the most surprising to your average reader?
Kennedy's decision-making will surprise some people because, you know, we get upset if somebody flip-flops. Well, Kennedy said in regards to the U-2s, if they shoot down one of our U-2s, we will immediately respond and take out their surface-to-air missile sites. Well, when it happens and we lose a U-2, everybody thinks LeMay's got his fighter jets on the tarmac ready to go. Kennedy says no. He says, I'm going to wait a little bit longer because he knows time's running out and he wants to make this last-ditch offer. And LeMay's furious. He says, these are his exact words, he's chickened out again. We lose one of our pilots, and he promised to respond, and he's still not. But Kennedy reversed himself about quick response and said, no, we're going to take a little more time. I see some light here that might be the light at the end of the tunnel, and let's use it. So I love that about him, that he wasn't afraid to reverse course, look weak. He didn't care if he looked weak in front of a few people. He wanted this thing to be resolved peacefully.
Lots more of our listeners want to join us, and we've got time to squeeze in, I think, one more, Michael. So let's go to Josh in Berlin. Hi, Josh. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Hi, Michael. I just wanted to say, you know, some men are men of destiny. And, you know, when this happened, I was a boy, and I had had a tooth pulled that day, so I thought I could stay home and watch cartoons. And I was very disappointed that all the channels had this on. But, you know, I look at it as a boy then, but as I grown into a man, I realized that it was fate and destiny that those two men had hardliners on both sides that wanted them to go to war. And Khrushchev said to Kennedy, give me something that I can go back to Moscow with and show them right. We got this. And they wanted to make the Russians look like they went back with their tail between their legs. And Kennedy said, no. He says, you treat them with respect. Let them go back with some dignity. Don't treat them like this. And when he was murdered a little more than a year later, assassination is such a surgical term, he was murdered, you know, we ended up with Vietnam, and they said Castro and Khrushchev were very worried and very saddened because they said they felt that they lost at least someone that they could talk to and reason with, because after that terrible war of World War II on Russian soil, the Russians had it very fresh in their mind.
Right.
They were sick of war.
And they appreciated Kennedy's experience and calmness and willingness to view people with respect.
That's such a great point that you made. Yeah, you know, and Kennedy, when it was resolved, he told his people, let's not gloat about this. Let's, you know, present this in a dignified way, because we've still got to make sure the Russians really do remove their missiles.
How well do you think this period of time is taught in schools today, Michael? I have to say, I have a pretty good background in history, and there's so much that I did not know.
No, when I went to high school, they didn't even touch on it. So
really?
I knew very little, and nobody seems to know that we lost one of our Air Force pilots serving his country over Cuba.
Well, again, the book is called Above and Beyond, John F. Kennedy and America's Most Dangerous Cold War Spy Mission, co-authored by Casey Sherman and Michael Tagayas. And Michael, I really appreciate you coming in and talking to me. This has been great.
Thank you so much.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.